65 molecular tests reported on August 15th. That made the positivity rate 11.2%. 9,983 Texans have died as of August 16th. 143 more deaths reported than the day before, and 1,524 more than a week ago. Today, WTI crude is trading at $42.48. That is up 30 cents. Now, here are a few coronavirus briefs from CNN and the Washington Post. Some U.S. schools are struggling to manage a return to classrooms amid what the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention identified as a steadily mounting rate of novel coronavirus infections among children. An Arizona school district that planned to reopen for in-person classes reversed course after more than 100 staff members threatened not to show up. Los Angeles Unified, the second largest district in the nation, plans to periodically test hundreds of thousands of students and 75,000 employees for the virus to gain clarity on when in-person instruction can resume safely. More counties and cities in Georgia are eyeing mask mandates after Governor Brian Kemp this weekend ended his blanket ban on local officials imposing their own rules. Officials are scrambling to protect the integrity of the November 3rd election in the face of the Trump administration's unprecedented attacks on the U.S. Postal Service and voting by mail. House lawmakers will return this week to try to prevent Postal Service changes that Democrats feel could make it harder to cast mail ballots. U.S. stocks on Monday were once again inching closer to a new record high after notching 3 weeks of consecutive gains. Italy on Monday imposed its first new restrictions on daily life since coming out of lockdown nearly 4 months ago, ordering the closure of nightclubs and mandating mask wearing, even outdoors, in areas with nightlife. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the country's general election, originally scheduled for September 19th, will be delayed by 4 weeks. New Zealand is suddenly struggling with the wave of infections after a long streak without recorded community transmission. The CDC's forecast now projects nearly 189,000 U.S. coronavirus deaths by September 5th. More than 5.4 million cases and 170,000 fatalities have been reported in the U.S. Dr. Anthony Fauci has warned that if the U.S. allows COVID-19 infections to run rampant to achieve possible herd immunity, the death toll would be massive, especially among vulnerable people. And now here are a couple of longer stories. Wartime doctors battling COVID-19 rushed to treat the ill, but without knowing what really works. For most of April, Marilou Seidel felt like she was starring in a science fiction movie. Her husband of 34 years, Jeff, was sedated in an intensive care unit more than an hour's drive away in Madison, Wisconsin, and her only window into his world was a daily phone call with his nurses. His doctors, first at a local community hospital and then at the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics, tried everything to help Jeff defeat the novel coronavirus. A ventilator, an antibiotic, an anti-malarial drug, blood thinners, a blood plasma transfusion. Today, Jeff is alive, one of millions of people who have recovered after being diagnosed with COVID-19, the illness caused by the coronavirus. But if you ask his grateful family or even his doctors what kept him alive, the answer is unsettling. "We don't know, and they don't really know either," Marilou said. 7 months into the pandemic, frontline doctors have, in many cases, become experts in treating COVID-19. But they are experts without, for the most part, the most fundamental tool in medicine, solid evidence upon which to base their decisions. Coronavirus positivity rates are climbing in the U.S. Health officials are hopeful that a new saliva test could give Americans a fast and inexpensive way to learn if they have COVID-19 and help to prevent increasing spread. The saliva direct test from researchers at the Yale School of Public Health received emergency use authorization from the Food and Drug Administration on Saturday. If cheap alternatives like saliva direct can be implemented across the country, we may finally get a handle on this pandemic, even before a vaccine, said Nathan Grubaugh, a Yale assistant professor of epidemiology. The test comes as frustration grows over testing delays and shortages. 17 states are performing fewer tests this past week compared with the previous week, according to the COVID Tracking Project. But while testing has gone down in those states, test positivity rates have increased in 34 states. The test positivity rate is the percentage of tests being performed that come back positive for the virus. It's one of the metrics experts encourage officials to monitor when making reopening decisions. Part of Illinois will be under new guidelines after 3 days in a row with a test positivity rate of 8% or higher, according to a news release from Governor J.B. Pritzker. And now, as we begin to bring you the first of our recorded stories today, our first report relates to that last article we just read. From NPR, U.S. sees decline in COVID-19 testing. Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update for Monday, August 17th, 2020. I'm Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas, and here are a few of the stories we'll be bringing you this hour. A poll shows that one-third of the country says it won't get vaccinated. U.S. sees decline in COVID-19 testing. 14 states make contact tracing data public. Here's what they're learning. Why the novel coronavirus has the power to launch a pandemic. States wrestle with playing high school football amid COVID. And rural schools struggle with the road ahead in the era of coronavirus. Are all masks created equal? How to find the right mask to protect against COVID-19. And in a related story, as pandemic continues, some choose to wear masks that are stylish, too. First, we'll look at the numbers. From the Odessa American today, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 3,771. Ector County negative, 16,881 out of 20,880 tested, with 228 pending, 59 deaths. Recovered, 2,972. Active, 740. Midland County, 2,846 confirmed cases with 53 deaths. And the Texas numbers from the Texas Tribune, after another large increase in new coronavirus tests, rate of Texans testing positive drops to lowest percentage since June. 6,267 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of August 16th, 1,170 less than a week ago. They occupy 11.1% of hospital beds. 6,204 new cases were reported on August 16th. There were 117,365 molecular tests reported on August 15th. That made the positivity rate 11.2%. 9,983 Texans have died as of August 16th, 143 more deaths reported than the day before, and 1,524 more than a week ago. Today, WTI crude is trading at $42.48. That is up 30 cents. Now, here are a few coronavirus briefs from CNN and the Washington Post. Some U.S. schools are struggling to manage a return to classrooms amid what the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention identified as a steadily mounting rate of novel coronavirus infections among children. An Arizona school district that planned to reopen for in-person classes reversed course after more than 100 staff members threatened not to show up. Los Angeles Unified, the second largest district in the nation, plans to periodically test hundreds of thousands of students and 75,000 employees for the virus to gain clarity on when in-person instruction can resume safely. More counties and cities in Georgia are eyeing mask mandates after Governor Brian Kemp this weekend ended his blanket ban on local officials imposing their own rules. Officials are scrambling to protect the integrity of the November 3rd election in the face of the Trump administration's unprecedented attacks on the U.S. Postal Service and voting by mail. House lawmakers will return this week to try to prevent Postal Service changes that Democrats feel could make it harder to cast mail ballots. U.S. stocks on Monday were once again inching closer to a new record high after notching 3 weeks of consecutive gains. Italy on Monday imposed its first new restrictions on daily life since coming out of lockdown nearly 4 months ago, ordering the closure of nightclubs and mandating mask wearing, even outdoors, in areas with nightlife. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the country's general election, originally scheduled for September 19th, will be delayed by 4 weeks. New Zealand is suddenly struggling with the wave of infections after a long streak without recorded community transmission. The CDC's forecast now projects nearly 189,000 U.S. coronavirus deaths by September 5th. More than 5.4 million cases and 170,000 fatalities have been reported in the U.S. Dr. Anthony Fauci has warned that if the U.S. allows COVID-19 infections to run rampant to achieve possible herd immunity, the death toll would be massive, especially among vulnerable people. And now here are a couple of longer stories. Wartime doctors battling COVID-19 rush to treat the ill, but without knowing what really works. For most of April, Marilou Seidel felt like she was starring in a science fiction movie. Her husband of 34 years, Jeff, was sedated in an intensive care unit more than an hour's drive away in Madison, Wisconsin, and her only window into his world was a daily phone call with his nurses. His doctors, first at a local community hospital and then at the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics, tried everything to help Jeff defeat the novel coronavirus: a ventilator, an antibiotic, an anti-malarial drug, blood thinners, a blood plasma transfusion. Today, Jeff is alive, one of millions of people who have recovered after being diagnosed with COVID-19, the illness caused by the coronavirus. But if you ask his grateful family or even his doctors what kept him alive, the answer is unsettling. "We don't know, and they don't really know either," Marilou said. 7 months into the pandemic, frontline doctors have in many cases become experts in treating COVID-19. But they are experts without, for the most part, the most fundamental tool in medicine, solid evidence upon which to base their decisions. Coronavirus positivity rates are climbing in the U.S. Health officials are hopeful that a new saliva test could give Americans a fast and inexpensive way to learn if they have COVID-19 and help to prevent increasing spread. The saliva direct test from researchers at the Yale School of Public Health received emergency use authorization from the Food and Drug Administration on Saturday. If cheap alternatives like saliva direct can be implemented across the country, we may finally get a handle on this pandemic, even before a vaccine, said Nathan Grubaugh, a Yale assistant professor of epidemiology. The test comes as frustration grows over testing delays and shortages. 17 states are performing fewer tests this past week compared with the previous week, according to the COVID Tracking Project. But while testing has gone down in those states, test positivity rates have increased in 34 states. The test positivity rate is the percentage of tests being performed that come back positive for the virus. It's one of the metrics experts encourage officials to monitor when making reopening decisions. Part of Illinois will be under new guidelines after 3 days in a row with a test positivity rate of 8% or higher, according to a news release from Governor J.B. Pritzker. And now, as we begin to bring you the first of our recorded stories today, our first report relates to that last article we just read. From NPR, U.S. sees decline in COVID-19 testing. And now, here is part of a story that NPR reported from a new poll that shows a third of the country says it won't get vaccinated.
71% of Americans, you mentioned, now see the coronavirus as a real threat. That is remarkable. This poll asked people whether they would get a vaccine for COVID-19 if one was available. And what did they say there?
Well, we saw 60% said that they will get vaccinated, but, you know, a third, more than a third, 35% say that they won't get vaccinated when one comes available. There are huge splits by education and party on this. Those with college degrees are 19 points more likely to get vaccinated. Democrats are 23 points more likely to get vaccinated than Republicans. And public health experts have been saying that, you know, they need a big number of people to get vaccinated in order for the country to overcome the pandemic.
All right. So we have the election in November. As you look at these poll results, what do they suggest the campaigns need to focus on, need to prioritize here?
Well, first of all, like we talked about with coronavirus, President Trump really needs to show he has a better command of what's happening with it. And, you know, he doesn't get very good scores on race relations either. He's not doing well in the suburbs, and he needs to be able to show people who might be able to, who might be open to his message, that they think that he's, you know, doing better on that and is more in touch on that issue. You know, for Democrats, it's all about enthusiasm. Trump supporters say they're primarily casting a ballot for him, while Biden's backers are voting against Trump. Now, this poll was taken before Biden picked California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate, so we'll see if that can help the enthusiasm for people to vote more affirmatively for the Democratic ticket than just voting against Trump.
Next poll, we'll find out. NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Thanks, Domenico.
You're welcome.
Experts are trying to implement several things to fight the pandemic, such as rapid testing and the vaccines. Another way that they're trying to keep this virus under control is contact tracing. And 14 states have made that information public. Here's what they're learning.
Where are we in this pandemic? Here in the United States, we actually don't know. And that's partially because for the first time since this all began, fewer tests are now being done. For example, in Texas and Florida, two hard-hit states, testing has dropped more than 40%, and public health officials are trying to figure out why. To give us some insight, we're joined now by Dr. Ashish Jha. He is the director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Can you tell us, from a public health perspective, why this drop in testing is alarming?
Yeah, so it is really concerning because testing is sort of the first step to figuring out how much disease there is in a community. It isn't the end-all be-all, but it is pretty fundamental. If you can't test people, you don't really know how much disease there is, how much disease you're missing. And right now, I'm getting worried that we're missing a lot of cases in Texas and Florida and other states.
But couldn't it just mean fewer people are getting sick?
Well, it could, of course, and it's certainly that's a possibility. But when I look at the states with relatively few cases, like New York and Massachusetts, they're doing a lot more testing per capita than Texas and Florida are. So this is not about fewer people getting sick. This is really a whole set of other factors that are driving a drop in testing, and that's why I'm worried about it.
So explain what you think those are. Why are people not getting tested?
Well, we've all seen the stories about the very long delays. So test results are taking 7-10 days to come back in some instances, but a good chunk of them are certainly taking more than 3 to 5 days, at which point their utility really goes down. And I can imagine doctors are ordering fewer tests. People are less willing to get a test if they're not going to get a result soon. There are, in some places, long lines to get a test. All of this, I think, the barriers that we've put up to making testing simple and easy are really dissuading a lot of people from getting tested.
Yeah, a recent survey run by CNBC suggested that at least 40% of tests are coming back too late to be clinically meaningful. It can take many, many days in some places to get a result. How problematic is that?
Well, it's hugely problematic, right? Because by the time you find out that you're positive, it might be many days since you got the test and many, many days since you first developed symptoms, at which point it's nearly impossible to do contact tracing. You've probably spread the virus to a whole lot of folks and you didn't know it. So it makes curtailing the pandemic incredibly difficult. That's why we need test results that are quick, that come back ideally that day, within hours if possible.
You have been having a rather public difference of opinion with the White House coronavirus testing czar, I had to ask.
Yes.
You've said that we need to be testing at least 4 to 5 million people a day. And Admiral Brett Giroir says he doesn't believe that frequent testing is necessary. This seems like a fundamental difference of opinion, and there seems to be a pretty big disconnect there between what senior Trump health officials believe and what experts like you think needs to happen.
Yeah, so there's pretty broad consensus in the public health community that we need many millions of tests a day. And if you just think about it, we need to be testing not just people who have symptoms, who are sick. We need to be testing people in nursing homes, in schools, in hospitals, healthcare workers. We really do need many millions of tests. Even at 4 to 5 million, it would only be about 1 to 1.5% of the population. Many experts like Paul Romer, a Nobel laureate, thinks that we should be testing 30 million people a day. Admiral Giroir and this administration are really the only folks I know who think that we've largely gotten the testing right. I think the rest of us feel like we've got to do a lot more if we're going to bring the virus under control.
But don't you think that's a problem when you have health experts like yourself and the sort of coronavirus testing czar saying two very different things? I mean, it's confusing to the public at the very least.
Absolutely. And my sense is that Admiral Giroir really does believe, even if he hasn't always been consistent in his language, really does believe that we need a lot more testing. The problem is the administration has not been willing to put all of its efforts into making that kind of testing widely available for reasons that continue to baffle me. So he's stuck between a rock and a hard place. I'm sure he wants more testing for Americans, but the administration is unfortunately not willing to do what is necessary to make that testing available.
Okay, so let's set the record straight then. How often should people be getting tested and when?
Yeah, so it's really about who you are. So certainly anybody with even the mildest of symptoms needs to get tested because we need to find out if you're infected and if you've been submitting. But we also need to be testing high-risk places like nursing homes. It'll help get our kids back to school. So it's not about how often, but it's really about who needs to be tested. And when you add up the numbers, it does get into many millions a day.
Dr. Ashish Jha is the director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here's an interesting report that looks at why the novel coronavirus has the power to launch a pandemic.
Many viruses have the potential to cause pandemics, but it is the rare virus that actually succeeds. NPR's Ping Huang looks into the superpower combination of traits that have helped the coronavirus go global.
Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, Director General of the World Health Organization, says the coronavirus is a once-in-a-century virus.
It has very peculiar features, and the world has never seen anything like this for several decades.
All the way back to the 1918 flu pandemic. Carlos Zambrana Torrelio agrees. He's an ecologist with the nonprofit EcoHealth Alliance, and he says there are hundreds of coronaviruses in bats alone that could theoretically infect people. He also estimates that there are 1.7 million viruses living in other mammals and birds.
A fraction of those are pathogenic, and just a few of those will become pandemic.
Most of those viruses don't have the right combination to be completely explosive. Dr. Megan Freeman, a virologist at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, says the coronavirus combines a few key traits that make it really difficult to control. Some of these characteristics are well known by now.
So I think transmissibility from human to human is one of its biggest superpowers.
Freeman says it's highly contagious and you don't have to touch someone to get it. All it takes is getting close enough to someone who is infected and breathing in their respiratory droplets. One infected person can get on a plane and spread the virus to a new continent. Another trait, says Andrea Prazlers, a virologist at Vanderbilt University, is when it's contagious.
For SARS-CoV-2, a lot of the transmission is from asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic people.
That makes it really hard to stop people from passing the virus on. You basically have to assume that anyone you come in contact with could be infected at any given time without knowing it. That's why mask wearing is required in many public spaces. Prowser says another trait we're starting to learn about is the virus's ability to jump from people to different kinds of animals.
We know that it can infect cats and ferrets and minks and all of these animals that are living in close proximity to humans.
Prowser says this suggests that if the virus starts circulating regularly among animals that we handle or live with, it might be really hard to ever get rid of. A community could be virus-free only to have it reintroduced by a visiting cat. So, the coronavirus is highly contagious, it spreads without symptoms, and it jumps with ease between humans and animals. Lots of viruses have some of these traits, but altogether, they've created a perfect storm virus that's causing a once-in-a-century pandemic.
And of course, we know nothing about it. It's a brand new virus.
Krasner says it means that everyone is susceptible to it. And researchers have had to figure out everything from scratch: how it spreads, who's more likely to get sick from it, and how to combat it with drugs and vaccines. She says there's a lot we still don't know, but we are learning fast. Ping Huang, NPR News.
Now I'll read a short Associated Press article, which will lead us into our next pre-recorded report. States wrestle with playing high school football amid COVID. Thrall, Texas. As heat waves rose from the crackling grass next to a cotton field that stretched far into the distance, Rick Porter watched his young football players struggle through a preseason practice. Under every helmet was a masked player, breathing deep amid the dust and stifling heat topping 100 degrees. August in Texas can be cruel, and the coronavirus pandemic has thrown a new set of obstacles in the way. Social distancing, Porter yelled, as the players headed for a water break. Nearby were hand-washing stations the coach built himself by drilling holes into long pieces of PVC pipe bought at a local hardware store. Still, Porter wonders if it will be enough to stave off an outbreak and whether his farming community, 40 miles outside Austin, will see football on Friday nights. I just hope, Porter says with a sigh through his own cotton mask, that we still get to play. Just like big-time college football, American high school sports is starkly divided on whether to play this fall. While the national COVID-19 death toll has passed 160,000 and total infections rise above 5 million, more than a dozen states in the District of Columbia have suspended football and other sports until at least spring. Their ranks include California, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Maryland, and Illinois. But Texas and dozens of other states are pressing on amid questions about safety and COVID-19's long-term health impact on young athletes. Many teams are already practicing. Utah played its first games this week. At one of them, Davis High coach Mitch Arquette told players to seize the moment before a 24-20 win over Harriman. It really is the mantra of 2020, win the day, Arquette told the Deseret News. You don't know when you're going to get together. We really don't. We could have our game canceled next week. Florida gave its high schools the OK Friday to begin later this month. Football-crazy Ohio was waiting for the go-ahead from Governor Mike DeWine, who has hinted schools will be allowed to play a shortened season. One top recruit has already decided he won't. Defensive end Jack Sawyer tweeted that he won't play and will wait to join Ohio State in the spring. Texas, which has by far the most high school football players in the nation, with about 170,000, will play despite a COVID-19 death toll approaching 10,000, and health experts predicting a rise in new cases as schools open their classrooms. The Lone Star State will stagger its season, with small schools kicking off in late August and the big schools in late September. Recent decisions by the Big Ten and the Pac-12 to call off fall sports raise a new dilemma for high schools. If two college conferences with some of the nation's most prestigious universities and medical expertise were willing to abandon sports, then should high schools be playing? That's a good question. I don't think anybody has the right answer, said Dr. Susanna Briskin, Associate Professor of Pediatric Sports Medicine at Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland. We certainly know the majority of kids don't develop any severe symptoms from COVID, but they absolutely can. They're susceptible to a more significant disease course, but at this juncture, it's less often than the older population, said Briskin, who also serves on the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on Sports Medicine and Fitness. The AAP recommends that any high school athlete who shows symptoms of COVID-19 sit out for 2 to 4 weeks and not return until they see a doctor. The group discourages testing unless an athlete is symptomatic or has been exposed to someone who is sick. At the college level, schools can throw massive resources at both testing and follow-up care for athletes. The Big 12 conference will require players to be tested 3 times per week, and anyone who tests positive must clear rigorous heart exams, including echocardiograms, a cardiac MRI, blood tests, and other tests before they are cleared to return. Riskin doesn't see any high schools likely to match that sort of concentrated testing and medical care. High school officials across the country have generally not required testing because of cost and availability, and timely access to a cardiologist can be a problem in both rural and urban areas. At the high school level, the onus falls on the athlete's family to be sure kids are taken care of, Riskin said. Texas will require any athlete diagnosed with COVID-19 to be cleared by a doctor to return to play. Officials for the University Interscholastic League, the governing body for Texas public high school sports, declined to comment on the Big 12's testing requirements and said no further rule changes were planned. Still, Porter wondered if stricter standards will be coming eventually in Texas or elsewhere, hurdles he says would be impossibly high for small schools like his to clear. If they just came out in high school and said, y'all need to test every kid once a week, you would probably lose every small school program, said Porter, who is also the Thrall athletic director. He noted that athletes at the University of Texas not far away will be well taken care of. Can we even get a test back in time in a 7-day or 14-day turnaround? He asked. If you can pick any one of the things colleges are doing, I think it would shut down almost all of the high schools in the state of Texas. Now we'll go on with a related article with schools. This one is not only about sports, but other things that rural schools are struggling with in the road ahead in the era of coronavirus.
So as school districts begin their fall semesters, some are under pressure to return in person. But public health experts are warning those districts that they should be ready to close down again. NPR's Kirk Sigler visited one rural school in Idaho where classes are starting up in person today.
At the Bruno Grandview School District, a couple dozen teachers are crowded into the small library. They're doing a refresher training in online teaching.
It's fine if you want to design your Google Classroom to be very student-friendly, but you're also then going to need to do some kind of checklist for the parent.
Parents in this district have the option to keep their kids home and do online only, go to school, or some combination. Regardless, in a small school like this, teachers like Maya Davis are expected to run it all.
So that'll be a little bit challenging to navigate just because teaching online itself was a full-time job, and obviously teaching in the classroom is a full-time job, but we're just making it work.
Davis is using a break in the training to finish up a presentation for her kids on how this year will be different. Desks spaced apart, a shortened school day to allow for more online work, and masks will be encouraged but not required except on school buses. In fact, Davis is one of only a handful in this crowded library wearing one. She commutes an hour each way from Boise.
I know that there's very few cases of COVID in Grandview, and so I don't want to be the one coming from Boise bringing COVID into the community, but I will absolutely wear my mask while I'm teaching and all the time.
There are fewer than a dozen known COVID-19 cases in the two farming towns of Bruno and Grandview. This isolated school is literally surrounded on three sides by cornfields.
And then if you walk out the back door, you're looking at the Snake River.
Superintendent Ryan Cantrell says when they abruptly went to online only last spring, some of his students dropped off the map. Learning suffered, especially in outlying areas where there's little or no internet.
There's a general consensus of let's get moving. Let's get the kids back in here so that we can find out where they're at, how we can help them.
Cantrell is telling his staff that last-minute decisions will be the norm this year. They're staggering classes to avoid crowded hallways. He'll also work closely with the local public health district to do contact tracing. But Cantrell is realistic about the plans.
I think it's probably just a matter of time before we're back to all virtual. I expect almost immediately to have to start making decisions about who comes to school, who's quarantined, what do we do about Mrs. Smith's class, do we need to shut school down for 2 weeks?
This is the uncomfortable reality in Idaho, where most state leaders want businesses and schools open. Idaho is one of the reddest states in America, with a big red mark next to it now as having one of the nation's fastest growing rates of infections. Republican State Senator Stephen Thane is vice chair of the Education Committee here. At a recent hearing, he pushed a bill that would take authority away from those local health districts so they can't enforce school closures or mask orders.
Listening to experts to set policy is an elitist approach, and I'm very fearful of an elitist approach. I'm also fearful that it leads to totalitarianism.
The argument is that local school boards should have the final say, not public health experts.
There's a lot of people that are willing to go back to school, willing to go back to work, and yet we're letting a few fearful people control the lives of those of us that are not fearful.
In the Bruno Grandview district, anyway, there is certainly some fear about the virus, but they're also worried about students not learning. The district has long been labeled as poor performing, and things had started to turn around until the virus. This is another pressure point for schools across the country, and there's no clear blueprint on how to go forward. For now, here's what third grade teacher Maya Davis is planning to do.
I'm hoping, you know, that I can keep myself safe and keep my classroom clean and teach my kids as much as I possibly can. I actually, on Monday, I'm going to have my whole classroom Zoom with a doctor.
A friend who's a doctor who's treated patients with the virus will talk to the kids about how they can protect themselves and their families. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Boise.
Now I'm going to read another article related to athletics, this one on the college level, from the Washington Post. We've got to do better than this. College students raise alarm by packing bars and avoiding masks. Music blared outside a row of off-campus houses on Saturday near the University of North Georgia as hundreds of students packed the streets and front yards. Virtually no one wore a mask. The huge party in Dahlonega, Georgia, captured in a viral Twitter video, was one of a number of mass gatherings around the country this weekend as tens of thousands of students returned to college towns already on edge amid the novel coronavirus pandemic. Local officials from Georgia to Alabama to Oklahoma reacted with horror and anger on Sunday, warning that unless students take social distancing and mask rules seriously, the fall semester could come to a swift end. Why, tweeted Walt Maddox, mayor of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, above a photo of hundreds of mostly mask-free University of Alabama students outside downtown restaurants. We are desperately trying to protect Tuscaloosa. Some universities are already battling coronavirus outbreaks, including the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where four viral clusters have emerged 1 week after in-person classes started, and Oklahoma State University, where a single sorority house has 23 confirmed cases. There's no national consensus of how to approach college this fall, with many schools going at least partially online and others trying mass testing of students. But other large schools are welcoming everyone back to campus and relying on masks and social distancing to avoid outbreaks, a plan, as local leaders noted this past weekend, that could crumble if students don't abide by the recommendations. In Dahlonega, university officials chided the hundreds of students who gathered at an off-campus housing complex for the Saturday night party. In-person classes are scheduled to start Monday for the school's roughly 19,000 students. We are disappointed that many of our students chose to ignore COVID-19 public health guidance by congregating in a large group without social distancing or face coverings, a school spokeswoman told the Gainesville Times. At Alabama's two biggest schools, football players were particularly vocal in sounding the alarm as they watched fellow students congregate without face coverings. Although many of college football's biggest conferences have canceled their fall seasons, the Big 12, ACC, and SEC are pushing ahead, assuming campus outbreaks don't interfere. At Auburn University, wide receiver Anthony Schwartz tweeted Saturday that he had seen crowds of people and none of them are wearing masks. Chris Owens, a center at the University of Alabama, tweeted a photo Sunday afternoon of a crowd of students with barely any face coverings in sight. asking, how about we social distance and have a more than a literal handful of people wear a mask? Is that too much to ask, Tuscaloosa? Alabama's athletic director, Greg Byrne, also warned that the scenes in Tuscaloosa put the season at risk. Who wants college sports this fall? Obviously not these people, he tweeted Sunday. We've got to do better than this for each other and our campus community. Please wear your masks. Maddox, the mayor, said he would ask the school's police force to help Tuscaloosa police enforce mask rules. Wearing a mask and practicing social distancing is not much to ask for to protect yourself, your family, your friends, and the jobs of thousands of people, he tweeted. In Stillwater, Oklahoma, the editor at Oklahoma State student newspaper shot videos this weekend of packed clubs and bars and long lines outside downtown establishments. The campus was already on high alert after the school announced Saturday it had quarantined dozens of students inside the Pi Beta Phi sorority house following at least 23 positive tests on Friday. I've decided I'm not going to class on Monday, Trey Sterling, a defensive back on OSU's football team, tweeted above videos of student crowds downtown. Stillwater Mayor Will Joyce said the city council would consider new pandemic rules on Monday, including an emergency declaration, if necessary. Every single person in Stillwater has a responsibility to help, he tweeted. Take every precaution you can to slow the spread. Wear your masks, avoid crowded areas, wash your hands, and be a good neighbor. And now we'll move from that story that's mentioning masks to a couple of articles related to masks. These are from NPR. The first one is, Are All Masks Created Equal? How to Find the Right Mask to Protect Against COVID-19. And then the next article is a little more lighthearted. As the pandemic continues, some choose to wear masks that are stylish, too.
Public health officials have been reminding Americans for months how vital it is to wear masks or some other face covering during this pandemic. We've been told they reduce the spread of the coronavirus. But as it is written, all face coverings are not created equal. This week, there was confusion over reports that a certain kind, known as the neck gaiter, could actually encourage the spread of the coronavirus. NPR's science correspondent Richard Harris joins us now to talk about, can we call it Gatorgate, Richard?
That's a great idea, Scott. Let's do that.
All right. Well, tell us the story of this controversial face covering. They're made of thinner fabrics, and they seem to be especially popular with runners, right?
Right. The story is about a fabric tube that you wear around your neck and you can pull up to cover your mouth and nose. And the misunderstanding about this is from a paper published in the journal Science Advances by a team at Duke University. A doctor there wanted to give away masks, but he was hoping to figure out which ones worked best. So he sent a bunch of different products down to the physics department. There, Professor Martin Fisher and a team, including his undergraduate daughter Emma, as a matter of fact, set out to devise a way to see how effective masks were at blocking respiratory droplets.
The aim of the study was never to do a systematic study of all mask types and mask materials. Masks vary all over the place.
He just wanted to develop a testing technique that he could share. And in the process of doing that, Fisher ran 14 different masks through this process just to see how well the system he devised would work. A volunteer would say, "Stay healthy, people," 5 times into a device involving a laser, a smartphone, and some duct tape. N95 respirator masks did fine, and most layered cotton masks he tested were also pretty efficient.
Did this routine lab study become a controversy?
Well, Scott, it turns out that one of the face coverings in the pile that was to be tested was this gaiter or the neck tube, whatever you want to call it.
The one that we tested was a 92% polyester, 8% spandex blend. It was single layer. You can stretch it out and you look at it through, hold it against the sun, and you can see the light going through it and you can easily blow through it.
And the test involved a single test by a single volunteer. Hardly what you'd call a rigorous study of this garment in particular, or certainly neck gaiters in general. But some reporter picked up on this finding and decided to write a story focusing on this single outcome and saying that neck gaiters essentially don't work as face coverings.
Richard, I've always thought neck gaiters make somebody look like, you know, they're a teenage mutant ninja turtle. But other than that, can they be effective in this pandemic?
Well, we can't really say much. In general, we know that materials you can see through and can easily blow through aren't likely to be as effective as denser material when it comes to mask material. But, you know, of course, the denser the material is, the harder it is to breathe through. So everybody would like to find that sweet spot where it's not too hard to breathe, but the face covering is still blocking particles.
What about those masks that look so official with the vent that help you breathe out?
Not a good idea. The single sample in this very limited experiment didn't do too badly, but the CDC advises people not to use them. Let's remember, they're designed to protect the person who's wearing them from inhaling bad stuff, not exhaling bad things like, say, a virus. And that defeats the purpose of wearing a mask to control the spread of the coronavirus. Let's remember the main reason that health officials are telling us to wear masks is many people who have the coronavirus don't know it. So we're mostly protecting people around us when we wear a mask. I will say there's also some evidence that they protect the wearer as well, but I would say don't count on that.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris, thanks so much for going into all this.
Happy to be with you, Scott.
It's a fact. Face masks can reduce the spread of coronavirus, but there's no reason we can't look good in them. The need for this new accessory has unleashed a wave of creativity. Take entrepreneur Ryan Glenn's handmade cloth du jour, which features
a bunch of like diamonds and rhinestones on a piece of material that shine very sparkly in the sunlight.
Glenn has already sold thousands of these bedazzled masks on Etsy. In fact, the internet is filled with these unique pieces. Social media is where you'll also find influencers wearing name brands. Think Gucci and Louis Vuitton. Even printing companies are getting into the game. Vistaprint is collaborating with artists to design new masks and sending out press releases that ask, are face masks the next sneakers? But at Ridgewood Middle School in West Lafayette, Ohio, Principal Brian Rage is creating face masks to make students more secure during these scary times. His fabulous designs, photos of his own face from nose to chin, printed onto cloth.
I made 3 masks with different facial expressions. I was smiling in one. The second mask, it is going to have my hand on my chin, just kind of like I'm sitting there thinking, trying to figure out what's going on. And then one with kind of more of a stern face.
Rach says he works with students with different types of trauma. So by showing his face, or at least a picture of it,
there's a huge safety comfort component that's designed specifically for our kids to come to school and be as safe and as comfortable as they can be.
But for some people, comfort is not the point.
A pandemic is no time to be modest for at least one person who commissioned a very expensive piece of protective gear.
An unnamed Chinese buyer will be wearing an 18-karat white gold face mask set with more than 3,000 diamonds. That buyer paid $1.5 million to an Israeli jeweler for a face full of bling. It is definitely a conversation piece, but you don't have to spend millions to be creative. Our Etsy designer, Ryan Glenn, says a fashionable mask is about making you and other people feel good.
That stands out, that's high energy, and make people smile while, even though we may not be able to see it under that mask.
But Glenn says there is one way people can tell if you're smiling.
Yeah, the smize. Right, you can use your eyes to smile.
Smize or smizing, popularized by model Tyra Banks. Pair it with a hair flip and you have a certified runway look.
And whip and keep moving and a smizing and a smizing and a whip.
So whatever mask you're wearing, make it safe, make it fashion, and don't forget to smize.
Smize and smize.
And as some people are looking for stylish masks, others are looking to the television. Here's a report on why we can't stop binging old shows during the pandemic.
You may be finding yourself watching and rewatching, and then rewatching the same TV shows during your quarantine. They're cozy, they're familiar, they're predictable, and usually always happy. It turns out our brain science has something to do with why we're not venturing far from our favorite shows. Dr. Pamela Rutledge is a media psychologist and the director of the Media Psychology Center, and she joins us now from Orange County. Welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
It's lovely to have you. So old shows like Friends and The Office are seeing enormous streaming rates now. Why is that in your view?
Yes, they are actually the most downloaded shows right now, the most streamed. And it's because these shows are shows that we're familiar with. And when you're familiar with a show, you actually develop a sense of a relationship with the characters, so they do feel like friends, no pun intended to the name. And, you know, they make you feel more comfortable. And right now we're socially isolated. We actually are craving time with our friends. And so these become kind of a proxy for that experience. And we know the plots. They're funny. We get the neural reward of a little chuckle.
And we get to spend time with Joey and Rachel.
Exactly.
Does the format of these shows contribute?
Well, you know, the format contributes in the sense that they're short periods of time, so it's a half-hour increment. So there's not a big cognitive drain to follow something that's complex and long. But it's really the structure and the predictability of the television shows and the plots that allow it to be so easily consumed.
What's happening in our brains when we sit down to pick a TV show, especially now during the pandemic?
Well, I think any number of things, and it really depends on the emotions at the moment. And so I think that's really an important thing for people to recognize is, how am I feeling right now? What do I want to watch? But shows like this, so we sit down, it's like, I'm tired from the stress. I mean, we're basically exhausted all the time because we're under this stress of uncertainty. So what do I want to watch that will give me some comfort and some rewards, that's easy, that doesn't drain my energy, but gives me some back? And that makes shows like The Office or Friends a very good choice.
What role do you think anxiety plays in this?
Well, anxiety plays a role because of the uncertainty, that it makes us much needier of comfort. It makes us already sort of used up. Our energy is a little bit used up from the stress. And so we're really looking for something that we can enjoy that isn't going to use more of our energy, that's going to actually reinforce or relax or allow us to escape and give us a little bit of a vacation, rather than tax our brains to figure out what's going on in a very complex plot.
I have to say, when you say that, it just reminds me, the thing that I find so comforting about it is that they even have laugh tracks, right? So you're even cued to know when you're supposed right. to laugh. So it's like all of the uncertainty is taken out of it. And it is comforting. It is comforting. My last question, of course, is, what are you watching these days?
Well, I'm kind of a British mystery nerd, so I have worked my way through, BritBox and all of the British mysteries that are the sort of cozy mysteries, right? They always kill somebody you don't like. They always solve it. The characters are very appealing, charming, and competent. So it's sort of my version of Friends.
Dr. Pamela Rutledge is a media psychologist and the director of the Media Psychology Center. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Now, here's an opinion piece, a recorded story. COVID-19 cannot stop the hum of a church choir.
We got a gift from a friend this week, a true note of grace in discordant times. You may know our friend, Amy Dickinson, who writes the advice column Ask Amy and is a panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Amy grew up singing in the choir of the Freeville United Methodist Church in Freeville, New York, where her grandmother was the organist and choir director. Amy is still in that choir today. But they've had to stop singing during the pandemic. Singing, even words of inspiration, propels aerosol droplets that can carry COVID-19 particles. It is especially incautious in close confines, including the spaces of a church. Services have resumed at Freeville United Methodist, and Amy says the parishioners scrupulously observe guidelines from the state of New York. They sit 6 feet or more apart from one another. They wear masks at all times. There are no Bibles, church bulletins, or hymnals in the pews. And, of course, no choir singing out, which could risk spraying out potential infection. But one Sunday, says Amy Dickinson, the 20 or so members of her small congregation began to hum. Here, their masked and wordless performance of the hymn, He Touched Me. We are humming behind our masks, Amy explained as she sent along the music, and it is the most heartbreaking and beautiful thing I've ever heard. It feels frustrating to hum, but the softness of it means that you were sort of sinking into the quiet and the sadness of it all. One day when this is over, we will tear our masks off with gusto and make a joyful noise, Amy Dickinson told us. But I will never forget this. Perhaps we will develop a whisper song or two to mark the time when our voices were still.
And in our final recorded piece, a very short, short story about some people who, in this time of sheltering at home, are becoming amateur treasure hunters, and they're digging for artifacts in their own backyard.
Okay, so here's one unexpected result of a pandemic lockdown. Many more people seem to be digging up treasure troves of artifacts. The Telegraph has reported dozens of backyard finds in the United Kingdom over the past several months as people spend a lot more time in their backyards. And this summer, Scottish archaeologists have been working to identify an astounding new finding.
I wish I could say we were excited straight away, but actually they were objects that I had never seen before. So I wasn't sure what we were looking at.
That's Emily Freeman. She's head of Scotland's Treasure Trove Unit, which is a government department. She works with amateur treasure hunters. So back in June, a Scottish man dug up a bronze object buried in a field near the town of Peebles. He called it in, there was more digging, and they found a haul of stuff that's about 3,000 years old.
So they are late Bronze Age in date. So for Scotland, that's about 3,000 years ago. And the Bronze Age is characterized by the use of bronze, the first metal age.
So among the finds here, a sword still in its scabbard and also a horse harness, and somehow the leather and the wood preserved in the soil.
Organic material doesn't usually survive because it's susceptible to disintegrating, to bacteria, things like that.
Freeman says nothing like this harness has ever been seen before in Britain. Her team has removed the hoard in its large block of soil and taken it back to Edinburgh, where they have a lot of work ahead of them.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Monday, August 17th, from the Recording Library of West Texas. Coming up, we'll bring you USA Today with our national news, and then local news at 3 o'clock. Here are some of the articles we'll be reading then. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Midkiff and Golf Course Roads intersection set to reopen. Oil prices hold above $42 a barrel. U.S. rig count decline continues. Big Spring Council okays mayor recall election. Health of Midlanders must be shared priority. MISD reports 30% drop in staff departures. MISD's new academic chief sees opportunity, not failure. From the Odessa American, county details data discrepancy. UTPB turns its eye to new media and photo. Honor those who were lost. It's been a year since Odessa's darkest day. Jim's Tall and Big Men hangs it up. First Odessa Christian starts Monday. Those stories and more on the way at 3 o'clock during our local news broadcast. At 6 o'clock, of course, we'll have the Wall Street Journal. And that next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today. Followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
If you're a do-it-yourselfer, don't let physical challenges limit your imagination. Each week, the guys on The Blind Handyman answer questions and offer tips on home maintenance and upgrades. The Blind Handyman, direct from Lufkin, Texas. Monday nights at 7, Saturdays at noon, and Sunday nights at 11. On Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 85 and partly cloudy. Tonight, a few showers with a low in the upper 70s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading articles from the USA Today, Monday, August 17th, 2020. Starting with the money section, there is no money line column, so we'll go right to the news. First item, some are still waiting for stimulus payments. This is by Susan Tompour. Restrictions or glitches may be behind the delay. While millions of people have received their first economic impact payment, a significant group of others who are eligible are frustrated that they've seen nothing or only part of what they're owed. Many still are wondering 4 months after the first round of stimulus checks began rolling out when they'll actually get their money. Some money has been held up by glitches, programming